Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Breakthrough the Noise with me, Jennifer Lindsay. I'm the Director of Digital Services at Eastwood Communications. Every week, we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick, trying to gauge the ever-changing landscape of influence these days. Today, on the sunny, warm Bay Area day, I have the pleasure of speaking with Augie Ray of Experience the Blog. How are you today, Augie?
Very fine, thank you. It's also a very nice day here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin as well. So
I was just going to ask you because you are not in the same location as me. So it's nice and warm. So tell us the temperature.
Well, I don't know if it's as warm as there. We're probably in the 60s, but we've been suffering through a bad month of winter yet. So it's a nice break tonight.
So get some sunshine while you can, right?
Exactly.
So let's jump right in. You caught my attention, and I have to say I wrote on our blog earlier, I've long loved Experience the Blog, so I think you guys do a great job there. And what I had said was, you know, when you do social media for a living and you read a lot of blog posts, there are very few that make you stop and think or make you go, wow, that's, you know, actually challenging something that I hold to be true or something like that. So that's kind of what happened for me this week. You had written a post called, Can Influencers Be a Bad Influence? Mm-hmm. And I have to tell you, when I first saw it, I felt like it was directly challenging the idea of this podcast, which is good, I actually think, because you should always be challenged, and you should remember that that you know, the dialogue is important to have. So I let's start by giving the listeners a quick debrief on what you wrote.
Sure. I certainly would not want to disagree with your blog radio program, nor with the concept of influencers. However, as with any marketing tactic, I think there are ways that you can do it right and ways that you can do it wrong, and that the concept of influencers in and of themselves is not necessarily innately perfect and flawless, that if you choose the wrong influencers or if you allow them to influence the wrong thing, that in fact it can be a problem. So I was looking to the world of entertainment to provide a couple of examples, and the first example was Snakes on a Plane. The movie was considered to be a crowdsourced movie because the writers, upon seeing that there was so much buzz based on its kitschy title, really opened up the opportunity for some of these fans to impact what they were doing with the movie, right down to, you know, its very famous line of get these snakes off my mother plane. That actually came from a fan. That wasn't written by a Hollywood scriptwriter. And another demand that these fans had was that the movie, which was going to be PG-13, they thought it should be R. So they added even more gore and more death to this movie. So, you know, they turned to somebody and allowed them to influence what happened with the movie. And, of course, once the movie came out, it did absolutely horribly. You know, all of this buzz online, and this was, you know, cover of Entertainment Weekly was all about mm-hmm. this buzz, and, you know, this was going to be maybe the first movie that showed that social media and Hollywood could work together, and in fact, the movie crashed and burned, and I suggested that maybe these people weren't influencers at all. They didn't really know the product, so they weren't influential in terms of saying, this is a really great movie and I have to tell people about it. They just liked the four-word title. You know, it's not much to base influence on. Moreover, instead of allowing the influencers to influence outward to really activate this craze that they had, they in fact allowed the influencers to influence inward, and they changed their product. And it could be argued that as a result of going from PG-13 to R, they narrowed their market, which maybe contributed to the problem. They also decreased the number of marketing opportunities and sponsorships that they might have had with a PG-13 movie. So while the jury is out, we can't know. I mean, I suppose it's possible that without all this buzz that this movie could have done worse, but at $34 million, it's a little hard to see how. So in that case, I thought that it was worth at least considering if the influencers had influenced negatively.
Go ahead, because you gave another example, and I think you were just going to go into that, the example where it worked well.
Right, and then this, well, and in fact what they did, and it's a kind of an interesting example of of deciding who your influencers are and not making the easy choice, Battlestar Galactica on television is widely considered to have been one of the best television shows over the last several years on TV. And it
many are saddened by its demise.
It is a terrific television show. You know, very dark, very mature. And so what happened was before it was premiered, they took some footage to Galacticon, which is a Battlestar Galactica fan event. And you think that these are influencers. These are people who care so much about this Battlestar Galactica mythology that 25 years later, they are still getting together. And in fact, it could be argued these are the only people on the planet who give a damn about this show anymore. So the producers take this footage and show it to the fans, and of course it's dark, it's mature, and they've changed one of the primary characters from a man to a woman, and the fans hated it. I mean, just hated it. They were booing and hissing. And so you might have said, gee, these are my influencers, these are the people I need to get on board, I'm going to change what I'm going to do here. And in fact, I give a lot of credit where credit is due, because the producer, when asked by one of the fans, now that you know that we're unhappy with this, are you going to change anything, said, and I quote, this is a quote off of Entertainment Weekly, said, this is the show, you may not like the show, you don't have to watch the show, but this is the show we're making. So instead of identifying as influencers these current Battlestar Galactica fans, they went and found other science fiction fans who had a taste for something a little more mature. And the thing that I, you know, in the end thought was so interesting was that Bonnie Hammer, who then was the president of the Sci-Fi Channel, said that she thought that you cannot let fans drive the creative process. And I actually think that that's kind of interesting, because for all the talk we have about influencers and all the talk about crowdsourcing and social media, I think there is an aha there, and that is that when you get right down to it, the essential business of those of us who are in marketing, and really the essential business of business, is to set the strategy and vision. Now, once that is set, involving people is very important. You know, getting it right, activating that word of mouth, all those sorts of things that we turn to for influencers. But I question, I guess, if it really should be left up, if the very important elements of strategy and vision should really be left up to crowds, or that that's what we innately bring to the table when we envision a product or service. So that was the long and the short of the blog post.
Yeah, and hopefully we're bringing research to the table that proves things true through examples like the ones you're talking about, whether it be a commercial product or a B2B product, that, you know, there's inherently a base level of knowledge and experience that we gain, from these things that have worked, things that haven't worked. And I actually was wondering, because obviously this is a timely example, and I saw you guys did a blog post on this yesterday. I don't know if you had written it, but if the underestimation of influence is actually something that played into the Domino's pizza debacle this week. Hmm. And I wanted to get your thoughts on that, since it's something that people are still talking about.
Well, why don't you expand on what you mean by the underestimation of influence first, because I find that interesting.
Well, I mean, the fact that, you know, two employees could, you know, make a video and it go viral. You know, the fact that, you know, you have this chain with, I don't have the blog post in front of me, but you guys laid out really nicely, you know, how many various franchises there are worldwide. And corporate office can't possibly know what's going on at every location, though they do say that they have these high standards. And one of the suggestions that I think you had made from a PR perspective, marketing perspective, to Domino's was, instead of issuing so many, very corporate press releases, was to turn to the employees that they have that are proud to work at Domino's and have them create viral videos or, you know, other material that they spread on the web to show some pride.
Right. Well, and, you know,
it's okay. It just seemed like you were pointing out that obviously the people that work there have influence, and we saw it work in a bad way, and you were suggesting, or the blog post was suggesting, using it or trying to leverage it in a positive way for Domino's. And it seemed like, you know, in the process, if you think about it, the higher-ups are kind of, again, whether you take, you know, the positive example or where the debacle started, there's kind of this underestimation of the fact that if you're very close to a product, you have influence about it or around it.
Well, I think it's also a question of authenticity here because, yes, Domino's had this PR problem where a couple of, probably low-wage kitchen workers, some teens, had a little fun with a video camera, and they showed themselves putting slices of cheese up their nose and then dropping it onto the food that they were going to deliver to customers. One of these people was also seen in some other videos doing things like wiping a kitchen sponge on his backside. And so this became a PR nightmare, of course. Now, one way to give Domino's some credit where credit is due is that we've seen in the past when faced with social media disasters like this where things are spreading virally and very, very quickly that the innate sort of reaction from corporate America is to issue a press release. Because that's their weapon of choice. The problem is that as millions of people are seeing a video online, issuing a press release doesn't really get the news into the right hands. So one of the things that Domino's did that I respect is that they trained a camera on their CEO and had him speak, and they released that on YouTube. And so when people are on YouTube seeing these horrible videos that are damaging the brand, being able to also see the Domino's CEO speak about this I think is very smart. The problem they've got, though, is that, as you point out, they've got 8,000 stores around the globe, and there's sort of an insidious image that this plants, and that the question is what is going on when the bosses aren't watching? So having the CEO say, some nice things about how much they care about their customers and food safety and the hiring standards and all that sort of stuff is great, but that doesn't actually attack the image that's been planted. It's nice that they're on YouTube, but does it really solve the problem? And it comes back to that word authenticity. I mean, when you have a question about what's happening in back of 8,000 stores, does the CEO actually have the authenticity to speak to that? And it's kind of a hard message to hear because, of course, he is the CEO. But he doesn't really, in fact, represent what happens in the kitchen of every one of those 8,000 stores. So what we suggested on the blog, there is some risk here, and I want to, address that, but this is that sort of continued letting go of control that we've seen has been sort of required as the Internet has grown over the last 14 years and is going to continue to happen as social media grows. But what we suggested is instead of the CEO speaking, what if they issued a challenge to all of their employees to train a camera on themselves and to express what they felt when they saw that video, to share how it made them feel. And to not issue talking points because that would, damage the authenticity, to not even ask that these be positive, to just simply say, what we want to see is what our employees feel about what happened here. Because my guess is that most, if not all, of the videos that would be posted, and possibly hundreds, maybe even, who knows, thousands across these 8,000 stores, are going to be people who look exactly like the two people who were sticking cheese up their nose, only they're going to be saying how committed they are to getting the job done right, how much they take their job seriously, what a wonderful place Domino's is to work, how much they love their customers. And those are the people who have the authenticity to solve the problem that is running through people's minds about what is happening behind the kitchen when nobody is watching. It's sort of a matter of figuring out who is best to attack this problem. And while, we can't blame the CEO for wanting to have his say and for the corporate side of Domino's to want to get their message out, the question is to really combat this question, who do you turn to but perhaps other employees?
So in the sense that basically this debacle became something like a campaign against Domino's, I think is fair to say, does that to you mean that these two employees had some level of influence?
Well, I think you can't deny that they've had influence. You look at two teenagers who, shot a video, and the next thing you know, it's been seen a million times, and it's putting Domino's on the defensive. But the problem with social media and what's wonderful about social media is that any of us can have influence. But there are going to be negative implications. I mean, there are some really very well-known and very similar situations, like Mr. Unstable and Burger King. Last year, a guy on his 18th birthday climbed into the sink of the Burger King at which he worked and took a bath and videoed it. And within a week, that video had been seen a million times between YouTube and Break.com. And so, yes, I mean, you know, he influenced Burger King to have to take steps to do things to salvage their reputation. And while none of these incidents, I mean, it's not like Domino's is going to be brought to its knees because of these two people, or that Burger King went out of business because Mr. Unstable climbed into a sink. But, you know, as we all know as professionals in marketing and PR, there's enormous cost to this. You know, for Burger King and Domino's, they've got angry franchisees who are seeing loss of business. You know, it harms business relationships. It harms people's attitudes about the brand. So I don't know if we'd call them influencers in a typical sense, because, you know, usually when we talk about finding influencers, we're talking about people who have a, you know, point of view and large networks and can influence others. But, you know, the point is, in social media, almost anyone can become an influencer and do so without really intending to.
Right. And I mean, that's kind of the topic of the show is, you know, really defining what influence is and how it's changing all the time. Because, of course, in marketing and PR, you're looking for the target audience. You're looking to get input for various reasons. You know, the Battlestar Galactica example was a really good one where people felt the people in charge felt like they had a really great strategy and vision, and we're going to stick with it and look to other communities. But what I really wonder is, as you alluded to, with the opening up and sort of letting go that companies, particularly larger corporations, public companies, I think are really the ones, you know, when I talk to clients, I mean, specifically it's the public companies that feel this pressure because of regulation around, you know, social media. And so I almost feel like it becomes an excuse, and there's a need to point out the risk, as you mentioned before, of kind of underestimating the fact that influence can pretty much come from anywhere, as you've said. Would you agree with that?
I would. Well, and, you know, nobody the day before these videos went viral would have identified Michael and Lindsay, I believe are their names,
yeah,
as people of influence. You know, you would, no study, no research, nothing you would have done would have said, well, these two are influencers. You know, they didn't create influence in the way that some of us in PR and marketing like to think of influence. It didn't come because they had expertise and they built it over a long period of time and they had good things to say and they had a large network. You know, those are the ways we tend to think of influencers. These two created influence, you know, quite accidentally, and I'm sure quite to their horror, because they're losing their jobs and there's some talk of criminal complaints being filed. But they created influence by doing something shocking and stupid. And sometimes that's all it takes in social media.
I know. It's something that is kind of a blessing and a curse, as you know, as you sort of alluded to. So something I always ask folks that are willing and lovely enough to come on the program is defining the word influence, because I think we can sometimes get ahead of ourselves and we forget kind of where we started. So how do you, in your work, how do you define influence?
That's a really good question, and truthfully, we don't ponder that a lot, and maybe we don't ponder it enough. I guess off the cuff, I would say that influence is the ability and opportunity to change the actions and beliefs of others. And it's fairly simple and maybe pretty obvious, but, you know, whether you're talking about Robert Scoble and the influence he has, or Guy Kawasaki and the influence he has, and these are, you know, leaders and thinkers in social media who have very large networks, where you're talking about Michael and Lindsay at Domino's, they both fit that definition. They have, either through their actions or their thinking, have altered the actions and beliefs of other people.
And I think, you know, part of, obviously, the challenge to those of us that do this for a living is how this influence translates online, because I think there's an interesting connection between different trends we've seen over time with word of mouth, and it being very similar in the sense that the authenticity has to be there. So, you know, kind of the advertising 101 with, you know, if you look at daytime ads with mom with the kids in the background talking about her day and needing to eat, you know, a fiber-loaded, yogurt to take care of herself while she's busy is meant to feel like an endorsement from a mom like you, if you're a mom.
Correct. At an emotional level.
Exactly, at this base level that we're kind of hardwired to respond to. So I wonder, you know, how much do you consider and or look at, because one of the things I have to say I love about your blog is, and please go to experience the blog. We have it linked on our website, blogs.eastwick.com, and check it out. I would highly recommend subscribing to it because there's lots of interesting fodder there. And not only that, they source and put a lot of quotes. And so somebody who went to Columbia Journalism School like myself loves blogs that do that, because it can be maddening when people sort of are constantly saying, well, we all know, you know, and yet, you know, we're working with lots, as social media folks, we often are working with people that aren't as familiar, and you do need to go back to whatever the source was of something. So it's a really great, great blog to check out. But I think that, you know, that's one of the things I really wonder about is, you know, in terms of influence, your own blog has however many followers it has and admirers. Do you consider yourself an influencer?
I guess of sorts, although, you know, it's all a matter of scale. I've heard a term just in the last couple of months that described the phenomenon in social media of having followers as micro fame. And I kind of like that term. You know, I don't think of myself as famous by any stretch of the imagination. Some of the people I've mentioned are, though. I mean, if you're talking about Michael Arrington, who writes TechCrunch, or is responsible for TechCrunch, or Guy Kawasaki of Alltop, you know, these are some really great thinkers who have legitimate fame. You know, I think I've got some followers on Twitter and some people who read my blog, and, you know, I appreciate when I hear things like, you know, you've referenced and said some very positive things, and I enjoy the constructive criticism I get. And I, you know, I suppose that it is all to, you know, have some level of influence. It's, you know, I do this because I have a great deal of passion for what I do during the day, and it spills over into my entire life, and I like to be able to share the vision I have. And so, yes, I'm, you know, I guess I am trying to influence some people to think differently about social media. Whether that
influence is substantial. Tell us more about that vision.
Well, it's interesting. I'd be happy to. I just gave a presentation this morning, in fact, at Marquette University here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where I got a chance to share a little bit about the vision. And my message is that I don't think people are thinking broadly enough about social media just yet. And I think what we're doing is repeating, to some extent, some of the mistakes that we made in the mid to late 90s with the Internet, where people didn't think about that broadly enough. When the Internet was young, many people thought of it as simply a marketing tactic. There was sort of a rolling of the eyes, and people would say, oh, now in addition to producing my television ad, I have to have a website now, don't I? There wasn't a real understanding. Of course, another thing you tended to hear, especially toward the mid-90s, was people saying, well, I don't need to worry about a website, that's not my demographic. And that was, you know, very short-sighted because, of course, demographics were broadening rapidly. So I see a lot of parallels to social media today, and honestly, and without a sense of exaggeration, I believe that social media is going to change everything. And what I mean by that is that it's going to change the way we form relationships and communicate. And that means there are going to be changes that we can't even foresee now, in much the same way the Internet brought changes that many people couldn't foresee in the mid-90s. You're already beginning to see social media not be thought of as simply an online phenomenon, which I also think is very important, because when you think about social media, I think one of the ahas you must have is that it's nothing new. I mean, being social has been a part of the human experience from the beginning. And so when you look at, you know, to go way back to 1517, when Martin Luther hammered the 95 Theses on the church door, he was just simply using the appropriate social media technology of the time. Church doors were the bulletin boards of its era. And he handwrote his 95 Theses, hammered it to the door, in order to get people to talk about it and to learn about it in the town square. He changed the world with that. But his reach was actually quite small. And then you look 200 some odd years later to Thomas Paine here in the colonies, who published the pamphlet Common Sense and helped to create the fervor for independence here in the United States. And at that time, movable type had grown, and his reach could grow as a result. So technology changed, but what really changed was his reach. And he distributed 120,000 pamphlets within the first 3 months and 500,000 within the first year, which is astounding when you think about what the population of the colonies were at that point.
Yeah.
And so then you come all the way to, you know, the birth of the Internet in 1995, and we sometimes forget that there were these things called personal web pages. And that services like GeoCities and Prodigy were offering you the opportunity to have your own personal web page. And what it was a set of tools, very crude, for you to upload text and upload images. And in some respects, those were sort of proto-blogs to what we now have now today.
Mm-hmm.
And with that jump of 200-some-odd years compared to Thomas Paine, now somebody had the opportunity to reach millions of people. So first of all, it's not new, and it's not simply an online phenomenon. But what we find interesting now is that what is happening online is beginning to drive offline as well. So you see things like, are you familiar with Twestival, which happened a couple of months ago?
Oh, yes, of course.
202 cities, they launched a campaign, a series of events for raising money for fresh water in developing countries. And so Twitter was used, and nobody had the job of scheduling events across the country. It happened in 202 cities, and if somebody had been responsible for scheduling events in 202 cities, it would have been very expensive. What they were able to do was find people who, through the Twestival website, were willing to set up small events where people paid to be a part of it, collect the money, and all that money went to the charitable organization. And they raised $250,000, and just last week, the very first well was drilled in Ethiopia, bringing water to a village that needed it. And so my point is that Twitter was used to create physical events in 200 cities and then, you know, actually solve a problem in Ethiopia. And so, you know, it's not just that social media is on Twitter or on Facebook, but, you know, it's actually beginning to drive the experience offline as well. So we do think that, you know, as the online tools grow, and keep in mind they will, when you think about the Internet of 1995 and what the top sites were, they don't exist anymore in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
So even though we all are a Twitter over Twitter and, you know, think Facebook is the best thing, you know, it's important to remember that 3 years from now, it's possible none of those sites will exist or that we'll move on. I mean, even Facebook itself, if you look at the history, of recent history anyways, of social media, there was a site called SixDegrees.com, which was very big about 10 years ago. And it really worked a lot like LinkedIn did, but it was ahead of its time and it crashed. And then Friendster was huge. You know, Friendster was enormous. And then everyone shifted from Friendster to MySpace, and now everyone's shifting from MySpace to Facebook. So our tools are going to change. They're going to improve. And if you look 10 years from now at the way the tools will allow us to network and to influence each other and then move that influence into the real world, we see some very, very substantial changes coming.
Have you had any personal experiences that kind of led you to where you are now in terms of really seeing this vision of, because I agree with everything that you're saying. I think that, you know, it's like the classic, you know, what job are you going to be doing 5 years from now? Well, I don't think it exists yet, so I'll let you know then.
Exactly.
So, you know, hopefully, you know, we stay open and keep learning and stay nimble to all of these trends. But, you know, in terms of what we have, you know, today, what are some of the favorite tools that you use that maybe people don't know about? So I'm sure you're on Twitter.
Correct.
And we know you have a blog that you are, I think, a contributor to. Is that right?
It is my blog. I work at... I write for it solely and have been encouraging some of my peers to also contribute, but much like the cobbler's children in that old, very tired analogy, we're so busy working for clients, it's really hard to find the time to do it. So
I would agree
everything
I've
experienced, the blog is mine. I have the blog. I use Facebook. I certainly do use LinkedIn to a certain extent. Most of the tools that I tend to gravitate to now allow me to do a better job of managing all that, because even that is quite a lot. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, whether it's TweetDeck, because I have, you know, 1,500 or so followers on Twitter, and some of them are Milwaukeeans, some of them are people who are in the interactive space, some of them are social media thinkers, some of them are Disney fans, because I'm a Disney fan.
Yeah, I'm a Disney fan, too.
Oh, ooh.
There you go.
See, already we're creating influence here.
I know. Well, that, see, this is because my husband and I got married last year, and we didn't do it. We haven't done our honeymoon yet, so we keep telling ourselves we're owed a vacation and a honeymoon. So
you are.
We actually want to go to Disneyland, so everybody's going to laugh at my firm when they hear this, but that's where we want to go.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I look at, you know, to maybe move the discussion at least briefly in a different direction. I've been a fan of Walt Disney. I've read several of his biographies. In fact, I'm in the midst of one of them now, and probably maybe the fifth or sixth of book I've read about his history. And, you know, in many respects, he was, as many great thinkers were, kind of a social media person ahead of his time. When you read about the environment he created in his studio, in the midst of the Depression, it's an amazingly open and collaborative place, the kind of place where people wanted to work, where they took a cut in pay because they knew that they could be heard and they would be doing the kind of work that they wanted. And so it's really interesting. There was a quote, and I'm not going to remember it now, but that actually used the term open, that it was a very open environment, and that really stuck with me because, you know, of course, open is such a strong word to use what's happening in social media today. So I think he was really quite ahead of his time.
So to keep on the detour for just a little bit, you have to watch.
Oh, sure, please.
A Pixar. It's called A Pixar Story or The Pixar Story, that talks about some graduates that are all very famous Pixar, you know, Academy Award winning creators now, and them coming out of California Institute for the Arts and kind of how they were received and how things had changed since Walt Disney had passed away and how they didn't really know what to do with some of the new ideas and what they did with that. And there are some really great examples that actually kind of follow along those lines, but in more modern terms, because again, it's all about seeing the pieces that relate to what we do in the evolution of companies, brands, people, their vision. So anyway, I just thought I would mention
that.
Well,
and really, what's interesting is to tie even back to the thing we talked about with Battlestar Galactica and the idea that maybe you can't turn to crowds for your vision and your strategy. I mean, you look at the history of Walt Disney, and it's fascinating. I mean, just to take one groundbreaking advancement of many that he brought to pop culture. And you look at that, at the time, his studio that he was considering Snow White, his studio had done nothing but gag-filled 4- and 5-minute clips of animation. And there was very little story development. There was no human form in them because no one had ever really convincingly animated the human form at that point. There was no emotion other than laughter and mirth. And he had this idea for a 90-minute movie, a full-length movie. And if he'd listened to people, including some within his own organization, they said it couldn't be done, it would be too expensive, people would not emotionally care about animated characters on the screen. He was told that the colors would hurt people's eyes. And he had this vision. And so had he listened to other people, he would have said, hey, you know, we're making okay money off of Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse shorts and the other things that we're doing. And he said, no, we're really going to stake our future on this because I see this as something important. And, you know, he changed the world. It premiered, was the most popular movie of its time, you know, won Academy Awards, and he changed the world. Something we take for granted now when we see, you know, 10 animated films coming out every year from different studios is that, you know, there was a time that people thought that impossible.
Yeah, absolutely.
So anyways, I forget where we were when we got off on the detour.
So it's talking about sort of, you know, your blog and kind of the work that you do, kind of learning a little bit about more where you sit in the world, what your everyday work consists of. We've talked about the blog being your original content. But what else consumes your work life and your home life, the tools that you use social media-wise? I think you were making the point that, you know, kind of connecting the dots and populating content even on a few social networks can be a job of its own. So you were talking about TweetDeck.
Well, my wife, for instance, I'll mention TweetDeck, which is a great way of when I had, got to having hundreds and then over 1,000 followers, I was realized that I was missing, of course, the important messages that I wanted of the people I was closest with. So TweetDeck, as I'm sure your listeners know, because it's very popular and well-known, does a great job of
Guy Kawasaki uses it, so.
Yep. Yeah, it's terrific. I do have some complaints, and I understand that some people are working on some new tools. One of the problems with TweetDeck is that as you categorize people, it is an application that sits on your computer. So if you've got a computer at work and a computer at home, and maybe you sign on at a friend's house, there's no way of making that categorization mobile, which is, I think, a big drawback. So I've heard that somebody, either TweetDeck or somebody else, is working on TweetDeck for the web so that you can sign on and get all that categorization in one spot so it can follow you. That would be terrific.
Yeah.
Also, my wife and I own a small business here in Milwaukee. In addition to my day job, we have a pet boutique. And as a result of the pet boutique, we also have an online business selling pet strollers of all things, kind of a funny line of business, I guess. We're one of the largest retailers of pet strollers in the country, which is something that we, sort of accidentally had happen. I shouldn't say accidentally. We had some vision around that nobody was making a site dedicated only to pet strollers and that there was an opportunity to do this for this very unique, very new product. But to your point, now what happens is I've got different accounts that I have to maintain. We want to tweet every now and then about pet strollers, and my wife wants to tweet about her pet boutique and the new things that she gets in, and when there's deals and, funny pet videos that she sees, and all the things that have to become part of what you offer to your social network. It's not just about you wanting to sell. It's about providing some value and creating a personality. But now I've got numerous Twitter accounts to maintain. And again, there are a number of tools that do this, but one I happen to particularly like that I'd share is called Hootsuite, HOOTSUITE.com. And you can maintain multiple Twitter accounts. You can see replies on all those, direct messages on all those. It also has a built-in link shortener that will track the number of clicks, so you can actually see some stats in relation to how many clicks are going through to the links that you share.
Tracking
none of
is always nice to have. Big proponent
yep.
of tracking myself. So
none of these, and another one that everyone knows about is ping.fm, which allows me to post simultaneously to my Facebook as well as my my Twitter account, and I am a fan of Brightkite for geolocation. But these are pretty common tools. I think the essence of success in social media isn't in the tools, although they certainly are helpful, and it kind of behooves us to pay attention to the development and changes and new things that are coming along. But, success really is about, creating a personality and connecting with people. And so that's been maybe the biggest aha is making the time to do that.
Well, I am at past the halfway point, actually, here. So I just want to welcome any new listeners to Break Through the Noise with me, Jennifer Lindsay of Eastwick Communications. I'm chatting with Augie Ray from Experience the Blog, among other things. I wanted to ask you, so how long have you been blogging, and how did that come about?
Well, it's interesting. You asked a question earlier that I'm not sure I gave an answer to, but you wanted to know, what was maybe an aha that made me realize where social media was going. And let me start there, because when I first got, and it actually involves the Disney fandom that you and I were talking about, when the Internet first went public in 95, I saw it as a way of sharing my excitement for Disney. And so, oh my gosh, this HTML stuff is so easy. I can create websites. And hundreds and thousands and possibly even more people can see it. And so the reach of this thing, of this new Internet thing back in the mid-90s, was what really turned me on, and I started creating an informal Disney fan site that actually grew to be quite large. In fact, large enough, I'll tell you that at one point when Disney World was celebrating its 25th anniversary, my wife and I got invited down because my site was so large. So
That's
we were
fantastic.
Part of the PR event. And it was
hey.
Great. But my point I want to make, though, is that when people started talking about this Web 2.0 thing, I actually rejected that at first. I actually rejected the concept of social media, ironically enough. And the reason was because I had always seen the Internet as social. For me, it wasn't a place to go and just visit CNN and consume information. For me, it always was a sharing place. And it took me some time to realize that what really is changing here is that the tools are making it capable for people to do things they never could. So, you know, as an example, I really would have loved back in the mid to late 90s, as part of my site, to create a true community where people could post their thoughts and a forum and, you know, do all those really neat things. But that wasn't within my technical grasp and certainly not within my financial grasp. And now you look at Ming.com as an example, and for free, and in 5 minutes, I can today do something that I couldn't even practically and essentially have done at all 14 years earlier. So, you know, the aha I had was how it wasn't necessarily that my attitude was wrong. Certainly, Web 1.0 was social in its way. But once you begin to see how the tools are changing and putting this reach into more and more people's hands, that's when I sort of went, oh, you know, I really get this, and this is where I see it going, because there's a definite trend here. So anyways, what happened was, for blogging, I started with a now-defunct personal blog. I didn't think about it professionally so much. I'm a guy who likes to surf a lot and find interesting links and share it with friends. Love the concept of internet memes and finding those things and sharing them. So I actually created a personal blog that was more about, you know, some opinion, some you know, viral video. And then as I was doing that, that allowed me an entree into seeing, you know, personally the power of social media and blogging, and I decided that I, you know, really ought to be getting serious about it, since it is my career after all, and launched Experience the Blog. So I launched that probably about 8 months ago. What was interesting is that I had a period where I could really dedicate a lot of time, or at least find the inspiration to do it. There was a period where I was posting 4 or 5 times a week. And this was taking up easily probably 12 to 25 hours a week of my personal time, which is, you know, pretty significant ongoing.
That's
commitment.
A big chunk.
And then I had a couple of things happen in personal life that, you know, including just silly regular things like the holidays came along and, you know, a vacation here or there, and I suddenly didn't have the time to give it that priority. So now I'm down to blogging just 2 or 3 times a month, and I miss it a little bit, but, you know, finding that time to balance things is what I find really difficult. But I still get so much out of it, meet so many interesting people, get some interesting comments, and a whole fresh perspective on things because I dedicate this time.
Great. And so you talked about being a marketer, so it sounds like that's part of your repertoire of services. So tell us more about, you know, how, you know, you and what you do for a living, and give people some context about you more as a person.
Certainly. I work at an agency in Milwaukee called Full House. I'm the managing director of the Experiential Marketing Group. We're a group of technology marketers who really seek ways to create some unique experiences for our clients, the kind of experiences that get attention, that grab emotion, and thus create something memorable and impactful for the brands that we work for. So that can be everything from Kleenex.com, which is the site that the current Kleenex.com is a site that we created for Kimberly-Clark, down to some work we do for MillerCoors, some very interesting things, where what we're doing is motion gaming, using Wii controllers to create custom games that MillerCoors then runs in bars for people who are 21 years or older, legal age drinkers, and these games are very, very popular. People line up for it, and we get the opportunity to, you know, have a branded experience with the consumer to change their in some subtle way, their attitude toward Miller beer. And as a result of the fact that the bar owners love these games that we run, they want to have Miller specials. And so, you know, it's just an opportunity to, you know, increase the discussion around the brand, and doing it in a way that actually provides value to consumers, as opposed to simply interrupting them with an advertisement, which is why we call our group the Experiential Marketing Group. What we're really trying to do is create these experiences that people will welcome and value, as opposed to the interruption marketing that they don't.
Exactly. So you gave an example, but is that your, what would be, you know, some examples you can share with us that are kind of your proudest moments in your current work?
The games are interesting for MillerCoors, and probably some of our proudest moments, because it was a concept that we brought to MillerCoors. They really, you know, saw the vision for it, and it's become an ongoing program for us, where what we do every season is update or create a new game so that consumers have something fresh. And we're getting feedback from the field, from the field representatives who run this, that consumers look forward to this. You know, they said they remember the game last year, and they were really looking forward to being able to do it again this year. So, you know, honestly, that's something we're very proud of. I guess another good example, and just to show the breadth of some of the things that we're focused on, is that we've created a community for our Kimberly-Clark client called the Viva Diva Cafe. And Viva is a towel brand, and you might argue, oh, there's no reason to have a community around towels and paper towels. And in fact, you're right, there is no reason to do that. But what we do recognize is that the people who are interested in the Viva brand, which is an upscale brand, that they have certain things that they care about. They care about having a nice home. They care about entertaining. And so we were able to create the Viva Diva Cafe, which has very many members, really has done a nice job of changing the way people think about Viva. They like to invite other people to be a part of this community. We found ways of bringing it offline, as we discussed earlier, so it's not purely online. There's a Viva Diva Tour, which is run by another agency, GMR Marketing. But what we were able to do was leverage the community we have online to create more interest in this tour, and then people who show up at the tour are also interested in becoming Viva Divas online. So those are some examples of things that we're actually quite proud of.
Yeah, I always love those types of campaigns, and I'm often suckered into joining them because I want to see what the experience is that, you know, that you actually get out of it. Just, you know, not from even a competitive perspective, but just for inspiration. You know, we find it in all different areas and different ways, and it's interesting how that works. How do you see the difference these days between, you know, and this is something that, you know, our firm has been very nimble about, but, you know, I see other firms not as nimble, or, you know, I'll go into to pitch a company and they're with a firm that, you know, has put up a Facebook page for them, and they're a high-tech company. We do have a lot of high-tech clients. And, you know, look, there's your social media program, and it just sort of infuriates me because I feel like that's not original. It doesn't have a vision. It's not specific. It has no, you know, growth. Mm-hmm. Again, it's very tool-specific instead of being sort of out of the box. Are there things like that that you've observed where people just, you that kind of are your, I don't know, things that irk you that you see in our world that you feel kind of diminishes the role of, that social media can play? Because I think there are some bad examples we don't really talk about because we're often saying, you know, social media is this great thing, but I think, you know, that we have to be cautious about that as well.
No, I agree. And in fact, you know, a Facebook group or a profile page is a fine tactic. I mean, it absolutely can be a wonderful tactic that is part of an overall program, but it is not in and of itself a program.
Or a strategy of any kind.
Right, and blogs are much the same way. I mean, one of the things that we'll talk about with our clients is that there still is a tendency when you hear the word social media, especially I think in larger clients and the publicly held ones as you were discussing earlier, to think about a blog. And, you know, we have nothing against blogs. We launch blogs and maintain them for our clients and you know, in the right place and for the right reason are really very valuable. So, you know, I don't want to misspeak here. But when you think about a blog, it's not that different from a corporate website. It is a design that is controlled by the company. It is content that is controlled by the company. The comments, if they even have them, are moderated by the company. And so when you think about what social media really is, a blog is almost like a half step into social media, not really a whole step. And so sometimes when I see press releases around the launching of a blog, there can sometimes be a little bit of a self-congratulatory tone to them. And again, while I'm not against blogs, and I think that a blog that is well launched, with a great vision, with a well-defined intended audience, with a message in mind, can be a terrific, terrific tool. But you know, it is not a social media strategy in and of itself. In fact, one of the things that we've been talking to our clients about is that there seems to be this focus on creating a social media strategy at organizations now. And we'd argue that is, you know, absolutely not the way to think about social media. We use this analogy where we say your company uses postal mail, and in some cases it uses it strategically, in some cases it uses it tactically, and it uses it throughout the organization. And that is exactly how we see social media. We call it a medium and not a strategy or a tactic. It provides for you tools that you can use strategically, it can be used tactically, and it can be used throughout your organization, everything from customer service, and of course there's been some really great examples of that. I've had a personal example where I had a complaint about my Sprint phone and voiced it on Twitter, and had somebody from Sprint reach out to me proactively, and within a couple of months I had a new phone, and I never once had to pick up the phone and wait on hold and be told that my call was really important, even though they couldn't get to me in 20 minutes, or any of those experiences that we've come to associate with customer service. So my point is that whether it's customer service or product development or human resources or marketing or PR, social media can be used by any of those in the organization. So, you know, we urge not to worry about a social media strategy. We say embrace it as a medium and then find the ways, the strategies, and the tactics that allow you to use it appropriately.
That's fantastic. I think you and I are thinking along some of the similar lines, and it's really fascinating. I think we could talk forever, but there's some other things I wanted to make sure that I asked you, because we're kind of, I think we have 10 minutes left or so, and you know, this is something that people ask me all of the time, so I'm going to ask you number one question, or maybe top five questions you get asked internally by perhaps people outside of the group that you work within, and then the top five questions you get asked at speaking events, like the one you had today.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you one question that everyone always asks is about ROI. And it's an interesting question. You know, I certainly would not want to go on the record as somebody who doesn't believe in return on investment. That is the essential, you know, job of business. However, I just recently read an article in just the past week where the person in charge of social media for Ford Motor Company was asked about the ROI of what they are doing, and he had a response that, you know, might strike some as a bit glib, but he said, I don't know what the ROI of putting on my pants in the morning, but I do know it's essential for me to conduct business. And so we get a lot of questions about ROI. And it does remind me of the early days of the Internet again, where people with vision would say, well, I'm not entirely sure how to measure this, but I do know it's going to be important. And in fact, they were right. In the presentation this morning, and it's maybe just an obvious example, but I use Jeff Bezos as an example, who in 1995 launched Amazon.com out of his garage, you know, famously out of his garage. And he was years ahead of anyone else. And even after Barnes & Noble got online, they still didn't have the vision for that the website was not merely to sell books. You know, Amazon has created a community, whether it's the wish lists or the lists that people create. You know, he had a vision for how technology was going to change the customer experience. I would argue Barnes & Noble's used the website to sell books. And so you look at that difference. And so today, when you look at the difference between Amazon and Barnes & Noble, here's what you find is that Barnes & Noble has a market capitalization of $1.1 billion. Jeff Bezos' personal net worth is $6.8 billion. And so for the people who have the vision, you know, I don't think anyone could have walked up to Jeff Bezos in 1995 as he was working out of his garage and said, please describe to us the ROI you see of launching the site. You know, but he had a vision behind it. So while I don't want to argue against ROI, I do think that you maybe need to consider ROI in a very big fashion, especially when you consider, you know, what's going on. I mean, let's talk about negative ROI to maybe bring it back to where we started, and that's dominoes with Lindsay and Michael. What is the negative ROI on somebody who, for nothing, you know, using their flip phone, which is, what, $150, their flip video camera, uploading their videos to a site that costs them nothing, you know, has caused arguably millions of dollars of damage to the brand image of Domino's. You know, how would you possibly measure the negative ROI of that in advance of all of that happening? So I think if you take a broader view of ROI, you begin to see where social media can play. But to bring it back to your question, I mean, ROI gets asked a lot. And I wish I had a better answer. Boy, there's nothing I would like more than to say, here's exactly how our ROI can be measured in social media. But, you know, I think that that's a really big question that we're going to have to take some time and some experience to work out.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that we engage, you know, or I specifically talk with some of our clients about is the value of return on participation, which is a whole other concept birthed by people other than myself, but I think is a different way of looking at it, although, you know, the questions about ROI specifically, you know, are getting more fast and furious because of the way the economy is. But I love the, is it Ford Motor Company management executive that talked about putting on his pants?
It was Ford, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's a fabulous example because I think that the risk to not being involved, or at least, you know, we say is, you know, the first trick of the trade is to start listening.
Exactly.
And we've been trained, you know, for even our clients that are shy about, you know, potentially getting involved in this crazy social media world, like you say, we see it as integrated. It's something I spend a lot of time working on professional development with our staff to make sure that even if they're working on, you know, more traditional work, that they are, you know, well-versed in what the newest, latest, greatest, you know, information is, theories are, et cetera. And, you know, because of that, I think we get, you know, we get new ideas, people asking new questions, but I think that even our, you know, our staff as a whole is better able to answer the question or give a different take about how we like to think of a way of, you know, basically saying the investment is worth it.
Right.
Because we know that it is, and if it's not completely quantifiable yet, I think it will be quite soon.
I know we're running out of time. I just wanted to second, though, what you say about listening and that's a place to start. And it brings up that customer service where, you know, there are people talking, and if they are talking about your brand and saying something negative and you're ignoring them and waiting for them to pick up the phone, we shouldn't really be surprised that damages their brand perception. So the fact that you are not listening to them on Twitter and responding to them, I think, says something about you as a brand. And the fact that maybe the brands that are says something else about them. So I just wanted to, as we run out of time here, say that I totally agree with you on listening as a place to start, and it is so easy to do.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that, you know, not to get too tangential, but you know, again, tools, lots of free ones, and there's one that we recommend to clients, and we actually have account teams set it up to take a look at for themselves and pass on to clients. You know, we say look at your brand and where it's mentioned, look at your top three competitors, and look at some key verticals or markets, up to two or three per client, and have that delivered in digest form to your email box. So, you know, as with most companies, we're very email oriented at our company, and so, you know, it arrives, it's relevant to you because it's a client, and you start to see and get in. And for me, I get concerned when I start to see, you know, one company leveraging, you know, different parts of their teams, because I think one thing that we're going to see is that, as you say, it's just another thing you do. So instead of just thinking about, okay, well, we need to have marketing lead this effort to respond to replies, really we should be, you know, what we say to clients is let's get a customer service person trained. Let's get a product person trained, and then they can evangelize to their group to be able to answer most articulately, especially in a high-tech atmosphere where a lot of these questions are, you know, highly specific to product. And then also realizing that when people, send you a note and say, we love your brand, we can't believe how great it is, that, you know, you respond to them in some way and give them something to do.
Exactly.
I think that's another piece of the pie, because I interviewed a friend of mine, Kevin Spear from Bunchball, a couple of weeks ago, and they have a software, or they create software that installs into user communities that provides incentive programs, some gaming, some, you know, badges and things like that. But the thing there is the whole idea of tracking, first of all, and understanding that You know, some guy at Dell Computer was answering more than 20,000 support questions correctly, and to that point, Dell had not had any way to sort of say thank you to this
right.
this man, and therefore incentivize him and others to continue along that path, which I think is such an important one.
Mm-hmm.
But I thank you so much for being on. I had wanted to ask you too what it must be like being in Milwaukee versus the San Francisco Bay Area or New York City. But the next time that you're in the Bay Area, you have an open invitation. So our doors are open to you anytime, Augie Ray. Thank you so much for being our guest this week on Breakthrough the Noise with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Next week, our guest is Sam Whitmore of Sam Whitmore's Media Survey, SWMS. That's 1 week from today at 12 noon Pacific. As always, you can keep up with us on the latest on this show and Eastwick in general at blogs.eastwick.com. Have a great weekend, everyone.